This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kenk in for Jane Lindholm. Vermont has some pretty ambitious renewable energy goals. 90% of our energy needs, hopefully, will come from renewable sources by 2050. One of the renewable sources that's frequently mentioned is biomass. Heating buildings or producing energy by burning wood chips, wood pellets, or waste tree parts. Yet in 2011, when the Shumlin administration first announced its energy plan, the governor emphasized that he wasn't too thrilled about large-scale biomass. And he said when it comes to building new wood-burning power plants, the state needs to be asking lots of questions. We'll ask some of those questions today and delve into the pros and the cons of biomass energy for Vermont. Here to help us do that are Bill Keaton, he's chair of the UVM Forestry Program, and Tim Maker, president and CEO of Community Biomass Systems. Gentlemen, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Hello.
Listeners, do you use wood pellets to heat your home or an old-fashioned wood stove? How does that work for you? And do you think large-scale woody biomass is a good choice for heating and producing energy in Vermont? You can call us at 1-800-639-2211 or post your comment on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Pete wrote in, I have trees that grow on my farm. When I have pellets growing out back, I'll consider changing. He says we don't have an oil well or natural gas well, so those are out too. Tim Maker, let me start with you. Anyone like Pete who has a wood stove understands biomass heat, but talk about how wood and wood products are being used on a much larger scale to produce heat and energy for towns, individual schools, college campuses. Walk through how the process works.
Sure. It's really all about automation. You can imagine trying to heat a very large building by throwing in cordwood into some sort of a boiler or a burner. It would be a pretty tedious job pretty fast, and you just can't do that. So the way to bring automation to use of wood fuel is to either chip it, which is simply putting logs through a chipper, and it just makes matchbook size pieces of wood. So it's just wood. Or to grind the wood into sawdust and then force it through a die and make pellets. And the pellets, again, are just wood. So whether it's cordwood or pellets or wood chips, it's all the same material when you think about it chemically. Pellets are even more uniform than wood chips, and so you can automate pellet boilers to bring the same level of convenience to home heating using a pellet boiler that you get with an oil or a gas boiler or very close to it. With wood chip systems, they tend to be installed in larger facilities such as schools or colleges or hospitals. And the main motivator there is the fact that it's a very inexpensive fuel, saving about 70% of fuel cost compared to oil today.
Bill Keaton, we just heard that, you know, certain types of wood, maybe the wood pellets may be more convenient. But are certain types of wood products better or cleaner to burn than others?
Well, I think actually the key question here on this biomass energy issue, which is a fascinating one, and which, by the way, there are many perspectives on, and it is an issue that the science is really very actively investigating as we speak, I think really the key question has to do with efficiency and the idea that different types of energy can be generated more or less efficiently from wood. So, for instance, it's pretty well accepted that thermal applications generating heat for buildings and municipal uses is a far more efficient use of the wood resource than is, let's say, electricity. And furthermore, if you go the route of electrical generation, there are what we call combined heat and electricity applications that are more efficient for those larger scale projects. So the is it cleaner question comes in really in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, certainly also the particulate emissions that have public health implications, and all of those things vary with those different types of energy uses.
Well, I had a chance to visit a power plant in Copenhagen, Denmark 3 years ago, and they were burning a combination of coal, wood pellets, and straw to generate electricity. And kind of what you just said, they were also harnessing the hot water that they were creating to heat local homes and businesses in Copenhagen. And I guess what intrigued me is this combination of burning straw, wood, and coal. Tim Maker, do you see that sort of a combination in the United States or Vermont, or are our biomass plants usually only wood burning?
Only wood burning. And one of the reasons that Copenhagen is so unusual is that they have been doing district heating with hot water as the medium for moving energy from plants to users for decades. And so 95% of all the heat and domestic hot water in Copenhagen is done through this huge network of pipes under the street that deliver the service to all the buildings in the city. So they're so big that they can grab thermal energy from wherever they can get it. They can take waste energy from a power plant, or they can have a dedicated power plant that might burn straw or it might burn wood chips, and they put all of that into the network. But we don't have that here. We don't have district heating systems per se. And so we're kind of starting from square one. And that means that in the foreseeable future, we're really going to be focusing on the biomass fuel that is most cost effective, and that's wood chips.
Well, talk a little bit about the efficiency of biomass for producing energy. And can you compare it to solar, wind, and nuclear, for instance?
No. In other words, the thermodynamics is completely different. There's a difference between combustion and non-combustion. So when you're harnessing the power of wind, there's no combustion involved. The same thing with solar. And when you burn a material, whether it's a fossil fuel or whether it's wood chips or cordwood, there is something going on there. There's a combustion efficiency that you can assign to that process, and you can measure it. But you can't measure the efficiency of grabbing energy out of the wind or out of the sun in the same way.
Listeners, what are your thoughts about large-scale biomass plants in Vermont? Do you have questions for either of my guests? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call to join our conversation, or you can post a comment or a question on our Facebook page. Let me take a call now from Stratford. John, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Just wanted to say, you know, that an important part of this whole discussion is that this is a renewable resource that we have here in the state, that we have an existing infrastructure that with our current use program that provides good jobs for foresters, for loggers, for truckers. These are jobs that don't go away but are renewable and go on year after year, just like the resource. And that we need, with the demise of many paper plants, we need a market for the lower quality wood, and it really fits in well with what our environment is good at producing, which is wood, and with the programs we already have existing.
All right, John, thanks for that call. Bill Keaton, what do you think about how this could be an economic benefit for the forestry industry in Vermont?
Well, I actually agree with the caller 100% on his remarks. You know, I think one of the things that makes the wood biomass energy so interesting is that it's really not a black versus white kind of question. There are many shades of gray on this. There are pros and cons. There are uncertainties that we need to look at. But in terms of the renewability of the resource and the fact that it's a locally grown energy, if you will, those are very definite positives. And I think to the extent that wood energy markets create an economic incentive for working forests, and in many cases, not always, but in many cases for practicing good forestry, the types of forestry practices that might even improve forest health and improve the growing stock out there in the landscape, that's a really important role for bioenergy. I think one of the concerns, though, here is that if we, depending on how far we go down the wood energy road, and also specifically what types of bioenergy applications we invest in specifically, large scale, smaller scale, that could have an impact on the demand for that resource. And there is a concern that that might lead to an overall intensification of the harvesting out there on the landscape, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just something we need to be cautious about, something we need to track. One final quick remark here. I just want to mention that Vermont has really taken a hard look at some of these questions. For instance, a year ago, the Biomass Energy Working Group, which was advising the state legislature on this question, and I had the pleasure of being part of that, issued its report and really carefully examined how much wood supply is out there that could be used for bioenergy. Also really looked carefully at the jobs question. And I think they struck a very balanced tone and provided some good recommendations for us to follow.
Well, Tim Aker, let me ask you a question before we get too much into the nitty-gritty of, you know, the emissions and sustainability. All those questions, I think, will come up. I just want to talk briefly about how big biomass is in Vermont right now. How much of the energy the state gets comes from biomass and where it ranks compared to other energy sources?
Well, it's interesting that we have a long history that goes back before even European settlement of using biomass for heat. That's always what's been done here. And so it's hard to quantify it, particularly for home heating. The firewood market is not well understood or quantified simply because it's so dispersed and it's people with pickup trucks and a chainsaw and all sorts of things. We really don't have great numbers on that, but it is a mainstay of our energy diet here in Vermont and has been for a long time. The big users are the power plants, and we have two of those, the McNeil plant in Burlington and the Reigate plant over on the Connecticut River Valley. And they use power plants typically use from 250,000 to 500,000 or 600,000 tons a year of wood chips going through each plant. So we can see that between those two, we probably have, you know, it changes from year to year, 600,000, 700,000 tons of wood, wood chips. Now, if you talk about smaller applications, such as our schools, we now have almost 45 Vermont public schools that are heated with wood chips. All of those together use less than 50,000 tons a year. So the heat use of wood uses much less of our available resource than does power production.
Right. And I also wanted to point out, as far as power production, the McNeil biomass plant in Burlington, I think, puts out about 50 megawatts of power, while Reigate puts out about 22 megawatts. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. And I wanted to put that in context. I believe Vermont Yankee typically produced about 600 or maybe a little bit more megawatts of power. So it's still not as much as we might think of it as, you know, generating that much electricity. Although Springfield, I know there's a biomass plant there right now in negotiations. But we'll talk more about that. We'll get to more of your calls, more of your questions when we continue our discussion. Tim Aker, President and CEO of Community Biomass Systems, and Bill Keaton, Chair of the UVM Forestry Program, are my guests today. You can join the discussion at 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. With the recent cold weather, my family's wood stove has been busy cranking out some extra heat for us. Do you use wood to heat your home? What do you think about burning wood as a way to heat whole communities, college campuses, and create power, maybe even some jobs? Biomass energy is our topic today, and here to help us answer questions and explain how it works is Bill Keaton, Chair of the UVM Forestry Program, and Tim Aker, President and CEO of Community Biomass Systems. This week, or maybe it wasn't this week, I just read about it today, the American Lung Association came out against the proposed biomass plant in North Springfield, specifically because of the pollutants they believe will be created. Tim Aker, what would you say to folks who are worried about large biomass plants and what they put into the air? How does the industry try to reduce those emissions, and how successful are they?
Well, I am not a particular friend of the idea of using wood chips for power production. If I was an opponent of a particular plant, however, the place where I would go to voice or focus my attention would not be on the emissions, to be honest with you. And the reason is that when you get to the scale of a plant that is has a capital cost of many millions of dollars, they can afford the very best emissions control equipment. And that is the case at the two existing plants. That will be the case in any new plant that's built. And those, the regulations under which power plants are controlled are set by the Vermont Air Quality Division, and they're very stringent. And so they can really force the utility scale plants to meet very high levels, and the technology is very sophisticated. At the opposite end of the system or the spectrum are the wood stove that we're all very familiar with, and the particulate emissions from a wood stove are far, far higher on a unit basis compared to a power plant. So I would say if you were talking to an air regulator in Vermont, they would tell you that they aren't very worried about power plants. In fact, the Springfield plant got a permit, has already received an air permit, even though they have not gotten their Act 248 permit from the Public Service Board.
But I have read that wood-burning energy plants produce more emissions than coal-burning, oil-burning, natural gas-burning.
Well, you know, the devil's in the details. I've been working with Goddard College, which is has a project to convert the campus completely from oil heat over to wood heat using a wood chip system. And we have had very detailed modeling of the emissions from the new plant that hasn't been built yet, as well as the existing oil boilers that are scattered around campus. And when you add up the emissions of the various types, and emissions isn't just one thing, it's sulfur, it's carbon dioxide, and it's particulate emissions. When you add them all up, it turned out to be just about a wash between oil and wood chips. But then when you get up to the scale of a power plant, it's another story.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. Again, 1-800-639-2211, the number here to join our conversation on Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about biomass. Let's go to Montpelier now and talk with Steve. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I got a couple of questions. One regarding the air quality. And my experience in Montpelier over the last couple of decades has been, at this time in winter, there's a really noxious air quality from lots of poorly tuned old boilers that are too expensive to replace in these probably oil-fired boilers in these office buildings, commercial buildings. And I'm hoping that this new district heat system will alleviate that. And I'm wondering if there's any way to actually put numbers on the air quality improvements that are available or possible with this kind of technology. And secondly, if I may, is inquire as to any of the combined heat and power plants. If we're going to talk about the large-scale plants that can afford the best air scrubbers or particulate scrubbers, is there a different scale of efficiency for if you're taking both heating of multiple buildings, district heating and electric power generation off the same biomass plant?
All right. Thanks for that question, Steve. Let me throw this one to Tim Maker first.
Okay. Let's see. Answering the second question first, it seems to make sense to use combined heat and power systems because they've been shown to be so effective and so efficient with natural gas. But with biomass, it's a different story because the technologies for producing electricity from wood are different than those are from gas or oil. And so the bottom line is that it's very hard to do combined heat and power with wood chips because it produces so much more energy on the heat side than it does on the electric side. So if you're really doing it to make electricity at a reasonable scale, there's going to be a huge amount of heat available. And the only way that you can get the efficiency that you're looking for is to have a place to put that thermal energy, that heat. And we just don't have that. As I said before when I was talking about Copenhagen, we don't have thermal networks where we can grab that waste heat and make productive use of it. So on an efficiency side, CHP sounds very good from biomass, from wood chips, but the technology really isn't there. We're stuck with 100-year-old technology, and it just isn't that applicable here in Vermont.
Steve was also asking just about the old furnaces out there, too, and ways to mm-hmm. I think he was talking about.
Yes.
Can one of you talk about that?
Yeah, I can speak to that as well. The Montpelier system has been under development for 20 years, and I've been part of that all that time. And so there have been studies, and one of the things that we learned fairly early on was that the air regulators were quite excited about the project. And the reason was that it would remove the need for these old oil boilers in residences and smaller commercial buildings that are not under regulation. They're not under the control of the Air Quality Division. And you replace all of those dozens, perhaps hundreds of small boiler systems that are not necessarily tuned on a regular basis, and replace them with a single plant using biomass that's under professional management and also under regulatory control, the situation for air emissions gets better.
I'd like to touch on another subject. When the American Lung Association explained why they were against the creation of a biomass plant in North Springfield, they not only included emissions from the plant, but they also included the pollution caused by trucks that they said would have to bring wood in from longer distances, because they believe that a plant that would use 400,000 tons of wood a year would not find adequate supplies nearby. Whether or not Vermont has enough trees to support the expansion of biomass, I think, has been a big question. Bill Keaton, as a forestry expert, I'm curious, how much biomass do you think the state can sustain, and is there room for more large-scale plants?
That's a great question. So as I understand it, the state currently harvests about 1.5, I believe, million green tons of what we call low-grade logs and biomass annually. And then of that, a large portion goes to home heating uses, firewood, cordwood. And in the past, some portion of that also went to the pulp industry. But since the most of the pulp mills in New Hampshire went out of business, we've really lost a market for that. I think, as Tim mentioned earlier, somewhere around 500,000 green tons, so roughly a third of that, is used up by our current biomass plants. By, I think, McNeil and Reigate alone annually consume just under 500,000 tons of biomass annually. For the biomass working group that I mentioned, BERC, the Biomass Energy Research Center that Tim has been a part of also, was commissioned to conduct a study of this very question. They looked at what supply might be out there, the net supply, the additional supply in addition to our current harvest levels and our current uses. And I think the number they came up with under sort of a moderate use scenario, sort of the most likely scenario, was about 900,000 additional tons annually that might be available. That sounds like a really big number, but when you start looking at the potential demand and you realize that, well, if we built a pellet manufacturer plant that would consume maybe about 200,000 tons annually, another big power plant would consume a couple hundred thousand, that 900,000 number starts getting eaten up pretty quickly. And I think this is where folks get a little bit concerned about that supply out there, and they want to be really careful that we don't eat that up too quickly. And I guess the reason there's that concern is that the more of that supply we start going after, the more pressure is put on the resource and the more potential there is for the forestry practices to start changing a little bit. Now, my laboratory at the University of Vermont just finished a pretty comprehensive study on this question. We went out and actually surveyed or inventoried about 25 bioenergy harvests around the state. And generally, we found that people were following pretty good practices right now, that when there was this bioenergy component, it wasn't leading to negative impacts of particular note. However, we know that there's the potential in the industry for that to change. Without picking on Maine too much, we can look over there though, and we can see how much more intensive their harvesting practices
sure.
are. And in many cases, that's because they're going after that bioenergy resource. And so that's something we've got to stay on top of, and something to track.
Yeah, well, let me just bring another voice into this discussion. Let's bring in the conversation Chris Recchia, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Chris Recchia, can Vermont's forest support growth of biomass, do you think?
Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Tim and Bill. Hi, guys. First of all, Nina, it's Commissioner of Public Service. You said public safety.
I'm sorry.
You don't really want me to have a gun. So I think, what I wanted to say was, these guys are experts in the field. So you have very good guests today, but I did just want to offer. I think the key is the sustainability of the forest management practices, and that's where we combined with Commissioner Snyder at the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation have been really focusing our efforts in looking at that. So that's probably, to me, that is the number one issue, to make sure that the forest can. Not only the forest trees, the number of trees we have, but that the soil conditions and that the type of ecology necessary to support indefinite sustainable regrowth of our forests is really the key focus.
Let me follow up with that. How do you measure the size of our forest? Because in a number of different articles and reports I've read, people have put out varying numbers for the same location, and it seems like those forest measuring numbers can vary greatly depending on whom you ask.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think I think there are a lot of assumptions that go into those calculations, and I think that it's within a range. It's not a precise number, and there is definitely some art to it. But I do think that, as Bill mentioned, the Biomass Energy Working Group, of which I chaired for a little bit. Was also looking at that carefully, and they came up with a range of about, I believe, the numbers went from, and Bill, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was like 500,000 on the low end to about 1.2 million on the upper end, so with 900,000 being about the medium. So there is definitely a range in how you calculate it, and you don't want to get down to the last stick in terms of trying to calculate this. But I think that 900,000 number is probably pretty good.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in. That was Chris Recchia, Commissioner of the Department of Public Service, not safety. I didn't mean to miss that. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
Fine. Can I just add one more thing?
Absolutely.
I think that, you mentioned the Lung Association, and Tim, I think, covered that really well. The other thing I would say about the Springfield plan is, we are trying to get them to do some heat for the industrial park there, a heat loop. But they also have proposed a wood stove changeout program. And as Tim pointed out, the wood stoves, the closer people get to the emissions, the worse, and smaller the unit, the worse the health implications are. So I think the wood stove changeout program is an important thing to modernize some of the wood stoves to the more EPA certified variety. So I think that's a helpful point as well. So thank you guys very much for doing the show, and Tim and Bill, have fun.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Richmond now and check in with Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. I have a question for each of your guests. I, as many people, are very concerned about climate change and the impacts of carbon dioxide on climate change. And I wanted to ask what the difference is in carbon dioxide from burning wood as opposed to burning fossil fuels. And I wanted to ask your forestry guest, can you improve the carbon sink of our forests by cutting trees?
All right. Who'd like to start with that, with the first question on climate change and burning wood versus fossil fuels?
I'll defer to Bill on both of those.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Bill Keaton.
All right. So I really appreciate this question. And, you know, I just have to say that this has been one of the thorniest questions in this whole bioenergy debate. And I just want to preface this by saying that, again, this is a complicated issue, and it's an issue in which there are very definite pros and also some potential cons. And on the con side, the greenhouse gas implications have been a particular source of debate. I also want to preface by saying that, again, this is being actively investigated by the science. There is not full agreement on these questions. It's something we're just looking at now. And the science needs some time to have a debate, to question, to probe, to disagree on that point. I will say, though, that gradually over time, we're moving to something like, if not a consensus, a majority view on the greenhouse gas implications. Counter to what might seem intuitive, by and large, the majority of the published peer-reviewed scientific studies on the bioenergy question have concluded that at least over the near term, there may be a net emission of greenhouse gas to the atmosphere if we intensify our use of wood for bioenergy substantially. Over the longer term of 50 to 100 years, we might reverse that through forest regrowth and by substituting wood for fossil fuels and avoiding the emissions that would have occurred from fossil fuels. But that's a longer-term gain, so to speak. The reason why the near term is particularly important from a climate change perspective is that there is abundant evidence that if we don't do something about climate change now, within the next couple of decades, there may be irreversible harm to the planet. So that's the larger context. Now, in terms of the emissions from wood energy,
Bill,
specifically,
I'm going to ask you. We're just starting to get short on time, so just try as briefly as you can to answer his question, and don't forget the second part: a way to make forests absorb more carbon. Okay. I don't know if you've got about a minute.
All right. Thanks for reining me in. So wood energy produces about 3 times the emissions of carbon dioxide compared to coal and about twice as much per unit of energy produced as compared to natural gas. So it's much less efficient, and that's why we get into some of these problems. Also, in terms of the energy produced per unit weight of wood, it produces about a fifth the energy per unit of weight compared to natural gas, and only about a third of the energy per unit waste compared to coal. And so that's why, even though it seems green, there are these complicated questions.
Unfortunately, that'll have to be the last word. I want to thank my guests. Bill Keaton is the chair of the UVM Forestry Program, and Tim Maker is president and CEO of Community Biomass Systems. It's a complicated subject, guys, and I really appreciate you taking the time to explain it and talk about it with us.
Thanks very much.
A pleasure being here.
This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. This week on the program, we're shining a spotlight on the work that people from our region are doing in foreign countries. Some are traveling for short stints as volunteers. Others are living and working abroad. But all of them are lending their skills and goodwill to make a difference. We're calling the project Vermonters Without Borders. And today we talk with Sass Carey. She's a registered nurse and holistic healer in Middlebury. And for the last 19 years, she's been spending part of the year in Mongolia working with nomadic herders on healthcare issues. In addition to teaching some basic healthcare education like tooth flossing and the importance of getting vitamin C, she's also worked to help local hospitals gain access to technologies they need. Carey's also been documenting the lives of the people she spends time with. Traditional nomadic herding has declined precipitously in Mongolia as people move to the city. Carey's been working to preserve some of the knowledge and culture of the herder's traditional lifestyle. Jane Lindholm spoke with Carey about her work.
Can you talk a little bit about the barriers to healthcare for nomadic people in Mongolia? Is it just not being in proximity to a hospital, or are there other issues as well?
The infrastructure in Mongolia is not up to par, up to what we have. A lot of it has to do with the remoteness, because the country is as big as from the East Coast to Colorado. And when I got there, there were 100 miles of paved roads. People that I first worked with when I did the movie Gobi Women's Song in 2001 were 12 hours from a hospital. They had a clinic there, but if they got sick in the winter when it's 20 below or 55 below, they really had no way to get to the hospital. Second of all, they had the clinic, which was set up by the Soviets. The Soviets set up hospitals and schools in the local areas, but they didn't have any equipment, really. So I interviewed the doctor, and I said, what would you like if you could have anything you wanted? And she said, a laboratory. And so I went around New England, Yale and Fletcher Allen and Middlebury and all kinds of places, and people gave me centrifuges and microscopes, and I was able to ultimately supply 7 hospitals, and also a medical technician from Fletcher Allen came with us and taught the people too. So we taught them how to use everything, taught them how to do white cell blood cell counts, and they could do that with someone with an abdominal pain, and then they could call in a surgeon instead of having the person take a very risky ride that they could die from, actually, and maybe not make, to the next hospital. So they would call the surgeon to make that ride and then remove the appendix at their clinics.
Well, and you do things like bring vitamin C tablets to mm-hmm. nomadic people because they have a lack of that. So making sure they have enough vitamin C, you teach them how to floss. I mean, you're doing sort of health education as well as making sure right. that facilities are up to par.
It's almost like two different parts of the program, because the part that you're talking about is about with the reindeer herders up near Siberia in the very northern part of Mongolia. Reindeer herders live in an orts or a teepee. They are the smallest minority group in Mongolia and maybe the most remote. So we did a 7-year study with the Rubin Foundation grant of a health database of the 350 remaining nomadic reindeer herders.
That's it, 350.
Yeah. And what we found was some of the people had bleeding gums, which was scurvy. And so that started our project of taking vitamin C. We actually looked into whether they had vitamin C locally. And we discovered that the way they used to get it was through organ meat. And also through milk. And of course, they still get it through milk, but reindeer only lactate for 6 months out of the year. And we need 90 or 100 milligrams of vitamin C every single day, every single day. You cannot go without it, without getting sick, basically. So that's why we started taking vitamin C. And we've looked for other sources. We looked at cranberries. Cranberries, you need a cup a day.
That's a lot of cranberries.
Yeah. And we heard about pine needles, and there are a few other things. You can make tea, but we haven't really come up with the right thing that fits their culture. So we take these little crystals. It's really just a small packet for each person for a year's supply, and that's really enough vitamin C. It was exciting this year when I was there. I was staying with a shaman, and his 12-year-old daughter wasn't even thinking, I don't think, that I was there. And she just reached into the hygiene kit, got out the vitamin C, put it on her in the palm of her hand, took it, and then walked outside of the orts and started brushing her teeth with the toothbrush that we had taken. And her father wasn't even in the home.
You know, so had just become a practice.
Yeah, which was pretty exciting for me to see.
So that's with the reindeer herders in the very northern part of mm-hmm. Mongolia. And mm-hmm. then you also work with people in the Gobi Desert,
yes.
which is sort of on the opposite side, on
yes.
the sort of southern part of the country.
Yes. And the Gobi people, that's who I was talking about bringing the surgeon in mm-hmm. and things. Their land is a little bit, the roads are a little bit easier. The roads in the north are very, very challenging, as they say, bone shattering. And to get to the reindeer herders, you have to ride the horse, too, for 5 or 8 hours. So it's very, very remote. Whereas in the Gobi, the people that I work with, you can drive there. And there, because they found the third largest gold mine in the world in the Gobi, South Gobi, the whole infrastructure is improving, actually.
Could you describe Mongolia a little bit
yeah.
more in depth? Because I think for many people, it not only is so far away, but it's so foreign and
yeah.
unknown.
Yeah. Well, it's south of Russia and north of China. And it has a number of climactic zones. The southernmost zone is Gobi Desert. It has sand, but a lot of it is gravelly, and it's not actually strong enough for agriculture. The only thing you can really use the land for is herds, if you move them enough to preserve the land. So that's what they've been doing for centuries and centuries and centuries.
And what are they herding? Not reindeer.
They herd sheep, goats, horses, and camels. And sometimes cows, but mostly those four, because cows really aren't sturdy enough for the Gobi. They herd also for meat, whereas the reindeer herders mostly use their reindeer for pack animals and for riding and for milk.
If you're in the capital, Ulaanbaatar, how different is that? Does that feel like a normal city?
That is way beyond Vermont. It is so modern. It's like the ultimate of modern, modern, modern. It's very youthful. Lots of discos, lots of bars, lots of action going on there. In the 20 years I've been going, they've gone from no phones to everyone having a cell phone, from no mail to email. The dirt roads become paved. The hospitals get labs. In 2007, the government gave each hospital a microscope, which is another part of our program, because then after that, we gave two provinces a training in traditional medicine, because we're trying to harmonize traditional and modern medicine. So we gave one half of the group traditional medicine, Mongolian medicine training from a Mongolian teacher, and the other half laboratory safety procedures and testing, so that they could learn to work together in the very rural areas with harmonizing medicine.
Well, that is one of the other things that you're working on with Nomadic Care, right? Is not only working with traditional medicine, but also working with nomadic people on these healthcare issues, because as I understand it, there's a lot of migration towards the city. And so there's a lot of this loss of traditional culture, which you think may partly be because they don't have access to some of the things that if they did, they might be able to stay in these nomadic cultures and places.
Yeah, that's the thing. I made a movie in 2001. I started shooting it, of five women in the Gobi. And I visited them in 2003 and 4. I made the movie in 2005 and 6. In 2008, I went back to see how they were doing. And some of them were still nomadic herders, and you know, some had moved to the city. I went back this summer, past summer. None of them are nomads. None. In the last 60 or 65 years, the country has gone from 100% nomadic to 33 or 38% nomadic. And the thing that is coming up for me now is that it needs to be documented, because we can lose it. They know so much. They know how to survive with basically so little. And they're fine. They thrive. They love their life. In fact, all the reindeer herders have been to school. Mongolia is 95% literate. And so even the reindeer herders, they speak Tuvan and Mongolian. Some speak Russian. They all know how to read and write. They've all been in the military, if they're men. And they've chosen that lifestyle. And so it's so easy for us to look at them as, ooh, those cute little people over there. But no, that's not it at all, believe me. They are really strong, and they are living in today's world. They have solar panels. They have satellite dishes and TVs in their orts or teepee. They know the news. They're up on everything. They're up on the fashion. They don't wear it, but they know. They listen to the soccer cup no matter what time it's on. They're just people of the world like the rest of us.
Now, how do you work through that without trying to impose your beliefs or your ideals
right.
on them?
I spend a lot of time listening. I can't really say so much. I mean, I have a translator, but I actually think that being from Vermont is a nice thing, because we have chosen fairly simple lives here. The more I think about it, the more I feel like we've made some really important decisions in Vermont on how to use what we have. I mean, we have this modern world with so much out there, and we've slowly and methodically made decisions to have it be a place that we feel it's nature and human beings, where we're living together and we're managing well.
Sass Carey is the founder of Nomadicare, which works with nomadic people in Mongolia to deliver health care and health education. And she's written a book about her experiences. It's called Reindeer Herder in My Heart, Stories of Healing Journeys in Mongolia. When she's not there, Sass lives in Middlebury. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Jane.
We have a link to Nomadicare, Sass Carey's organization, at vpr.net. Jane Lindholm spoke with her as part of our project, Vermonters Without Borders. Many Vermonters have stories to tell about humanitarian work they've done in foreign countries, and VPR is using them to build a digital map with photos and stories from around the world. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and tell us your story. Send us a photo and a paragraph about where you traveled and the work you did there. We'll add your experience to our Vermonters Without Borders online project. And you can learn more about it at vpr.net. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, our annual music show is finally here. What artists did you discover this year? And what songs did you have on repeat? You know, the ones you just couldn't get out of your head. Go to Vermont Edition's Facebook page and post your picks for the best music of 2013. And join us to hear the music picks of your fellow listeners tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the program. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. John Van Hoosen is our executive producer. From Peg TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.